God can use anyone, anywhere, and at any time. Hello everyone, I'm McDaniel Phillips, and this is Times of Refreshing, a ministry of Bethesda Hall in partnership with TWR Asia. Our host is author, teacher, and itinerant speaker, Kenneth Wong. Well, how do you feel if someone describes you as a worldly Christian? Insulted? Incensed? Humiliated? To be considered worldly does have a negative tone to it, doesn't it? Especially if you are a follower of Jesus. But Ken says that even though it sounds like a contradiction in terms, Christians should be worldly. Now, before you get ready to brand Ken a heretic, listen to what he has to say. In just a moment, Kenneth brings us part one of his reflection on worldly saints.
Hi there to all our friends listening in. It's good to be with you. We're going to talk about what it means for Christians to live in this life and in this world. And I've provocatively entitled it Worldly Saints. Now that sounds like a contradiction of terms, but there is a right and a spiritual sense in which Christians or saints should be worldly, in that they are to live their lives in this world, but as saints. This is in fact the title of a book by Leland Ryken of Wheaton College. He wrote about the 17th century Puritans who had a deep sense of vocation coupled with holiness. For the Puritans, there was no dichotomy between the sacred and the secular life or service. So we shall be examining the place and the role of the Christian in this world and in this life. We need to recover the sense of mission in the world, or we shall stand in danger of losing our testimony as the salt of the earth and the light of the world. We have sometimes heard it said mockingly that so-and-so is so heavenly minded that he is of no earthly good, implying that we may be contemplatives, living lives that are withdrawn from this world. That should not be the case. On the other hand, every believer should be so heavenly minded as to be of great earthly good. We're taking our theme from Jesus' prayer for his disciples, recorded in John chapter 17. It's sometimes called the high priestly prayer, for he was praying not just for his immediate disciples, but for all who will come to a saving knowledge of him through his death and resurrection. In that sense, this is truly the Lord's prayer, rather than the pattern prayer or the model prayer that the Lord taught his disciples earlier, when they asked him to teach them how to pray. The Lord prayed this great prayer in view of his imminent departure from this world. So Jesus was praying with this great thing in view, that he was going back to his Father in heaven, but leaving his disciples back here on earth, with a consequent thought and deep burden of his heart as to how they should live their lives in this world. In John chapter 17, verse 6, Jesus begins to pray for his disciples, saying to God the Father, I have manifested your name to the men whom you have given me out of the world. They are yours. You gave them to me, and they have kept your word. Now notice that phrase, those whom God has given him out of the world. So when we're called and saved, we're called and saved out of the world. But then further on in verse 11, he continues in his prayer, Now I am no longer in the world, but these are in the world, and I come to you. Holy Father, keep through your name those whom you have given me, that they may be one as we are one. So while they were called and saved out of the world, and Jesus was soon going to be no longer in this world, yet they are still in the world. And the force of his desire in prayer for us is conveyed strongly in verses 15 to 17. I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. Verse 16, they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. And also in verses 18 and 19, as you sent me into the world, I also have sent them into the world. And for their sakes, I sanctify myself that they also may be sanctified by the truth. From these last few verses that we have just read, we have these two positions brought out very clearly. Firstly, from verse 18, sent into the world. And secondly, from verse 16, not of the world. We're going to start today with part one, dealing with in the world, and this implies being sent. And for the second part tomorrow, we shall be dealing with not of the world, and that implies being sanctified. It is vital to have these two aspects of the disposition of the Christian as being in the world but not of it, held in good balance so as to be an effective testimony in this world. Let's begin with the first aspect, in the world, and start by considering the sense of being sent. This is often absent and non-existent in the outlook of many believers, but it's something to be cultivated and to be recovered. We have to start with the realization that every believer is called out of the world to God. And by the same token, every believer is also sent into the world by God. And they represent twin aspects of the Christian's vocational view of life, the sense of being called as well as the sense of being sent. Let me just compare this to men who have been enlisted as soldiers. They would first have been called up out of their civilian life to be enlisted as soldiers. But they are called up in order to be sent into national service, or perhaps for service in the war front. Similarly, Christians are also called out of the world and their past lives in order to be sent back into the world with a new and eternal life and a new nature. But there is a distinct order there. You see, one cannot be sent unless he has first been called. But if you have been called, it is for the purpose of being sent. Calling brings us to God and makes us his possession. We belong to him. And the consecrated life is to love God with all of our hearts, our minds, our strength, all of our being. In other words, to be wholly his. That, in a nutshell, is what being called means. It's to live a consecrated life to God. To be sent suggests God's sovereign posting and placing in our station in life, wherever that may be. And in the place that he has sent us, we are to be Christ's ambassadors or representatives into the world so as to bear witness to him. Now this points to the fundamental importance of the one whom we serve, and that never changes, over and above the consideration of where we serve and what we are called to serve in, because those are variable. It is the fact that the Lord has called us and sent us that is going to put the stamp of authority on our service and work. That is what lends urgency to our responsibilities. We are in his service, just as a king's subjects are in his majesty's service. Strictly speaking, we are never called to a work or a service. We are called only to the Lord himself, who in turn sends us to a specific sphere of service. Our calling remains unchanged. Fundamentally, it's always by the Lord and out of the world. But our scene of service can change in place and time. And that's especially so since our lives on this earth are to be lived like strangers and sojourners, a nomadic lifestyle, if you like, in contrast to being settlers. So wherever we go, we are still sent to serve him there. The next point that I would like to make is that it is not usefulness, but usability that is important. What do I mean by that? Usefulness is much too utilitarian a concept for Christian work, because usefulness suggests being used. There is a hint of exploitation in being used. That's what the word suggests. But God works with us as well as through us. And when we work with God in cooperation with Him and in dependence upon Him, it takes out the unhealthy sense of preoccupation with how useful I am and what I'm doing and how good I am in doing it. Be careful of thinking along the line that God has helped you get to where you are now. That means you are the prime mover, you're the driver, and God is the helper or the navigator. That's trying to live your life with a little help from God. That's not what a consecrated life is. If I have been sent and placed here by God, then it has nothing to do with what I have done. And I do all I can while I can to serve Him in the place where He has put me. The important thing is to be usable by God, rather than to feel useful for God. It's our fitness, our readiness to be used by Him that is the important thing. It's not ability so much as availability. God can use anyone, anywhere, and at any time. Now that's a really humbling thought if we have been thinking all along that we are indispensable, that others can't do without us, or worse still, that God can't do without you. If we begin to think in terms of usability rather than usefulness, then it demolishes the fallacy that serving God has to mean some kind of full-time work in some religious form. That's an honest struggle and dilemma for many a committed Christian who genuinely wants to serve the Lord. But there always seems to be this great dichotomy between my calling and my sending and my serving. You know, the feeling that if I'm called by God, what am I doing here? And if this line of thinking is taken to its extreme logical conclusion, then it would follow that all Christians would have to withdraw from secular work for church work. Now that's the direct opposite of what Jesus meant by being sent into the world. It hasn't primarily to do with where I serve or in what capacity I serve, but the essential idea is to permeate the world with the presence of Jesus through me, wherever I have been sent. Let me just go back to the earlier illustration of enlistment for national service. Now, if we consider the aspect of eligibility for enlistment, the principal criterion would be normally citizenship. If you're a citizen of the country, then you are liable. And if you're not a citizen of the country, you're not eligible. But where you are subsequently posted after you have been enlisted would depend on a whole host of factors like aptitude, physical fitness, or other factors that are related to your fitness for their purpose. Now, this is exactly the same with God's call and sending for service. All believers are enlisted by virtue of their citizenship in heaven and their calling, their heavenly calling. But where we shall be sent to serve and what we are to do exactly will depend on individual factors. One of the greatest lies perpetrated by Satan is that there are two kinds of Christians in the world, those in full-time ministry and the rest of us. The truth has to be recovered and taught and propagated that every believer is called as well as sent to serve the Lord wherever he is and in whatever he does, provided it is not morally wrong. Next, let me move on to a related question regarding the worth of work. The question is, what determines the worth of our work and makes what we do worthwhile? What is the measure of the worth of work? Is it an external measure like success, or is it an internal measure like satisfaction? Well, from the spiritual standpoint, it is neither. What determines the spiritual worth of a work is whether we have done it for the Lord and in His will. The reference point is who we serve. It's not what others are saying or thinking about it, nor what we feel about it. It's what God thinks and says about it that matters most. When we use the term spiritual work, we should not be using it to categorize work according to its external characteristics, that is, where it is done and what is done. You know, if it's church-related work, then it's spiritual work. What makes it spiritual is not the type of work, but rather the person doing it and who he is doing it for. For example, if you wash the church toilet, it does not make it any more spiritual than if you're washing a toilet at home or in the office or even a public toilet in the shopping mall or MRT station. You understand, the nature of the work is the same. The place varies, but the attitude with which you do it is what is going to make the difference. Even in secular work, the worth of work cannot only be measured economically. Let's just say that if everyone wants to be and is a doctor, then who's going to collect the garbage? Even the most menial of jobs, done as to the Lord and not to man, can be of greater worth and brings more glory to God than a highly regarded job done for its own sake or for my own ends. Our preconceptions and prejudices concerning work in general are deeply entrenched. But since work takes up such a great proportion of our times and lives, we really need to have a right biblical view of work so that we can happily and effectively fulfill God's calling and His sending for us in this world. Therefore, measure the spiritual worth or value of what you do by both these questions and criteria. First, what? Am I doing what He wants me to do? That is to say, is this His will for me? And second, who? Am I doing it as unto the Lord and for His glory? This brings me to the last point, which is about the Christian's vocation. The idea behind this is being actively engaged in the world, as opposed to being isolated or withdrawn from the world. We're not living in a monastery, we're living in the world. But we're not trying so much as to spiritualize work out there in the world. We're not using it as a front or an excuse for something else. Let me clarify. We're not talking so much about, for example, a Christian teacher or a Christian tailor, but we're talking of a teacher or a tailor who is also a Christian. In other words, what you bring to the job as a believer of Jesus Christ. So Christian in that sense is not an adjective, but a noun. It's someone you are. This can be a really liberating and emancipating thought. It frees you to do what you're supposed to do competently and enthusiastically, but as a Christian, as being called and sent, and glorifying God in all that you do. Therefore, it is not the second best vocation if you're not in some form of religious work. It's a wonderful thing to be able to enjoy what you're doing and not be unsettled by a wrong kind of thinking that this is not your best for Him. But of course, in whatever we do, it cannot glorify God unless it is also His will. And I trust these thoughts will help you serve God better with a greater sense of mission and motivation in whatever you do or wherever you are. Or it might be that what you're doing is not really in His will, that it will help you to change what you're doing or the way you do it so that you can do it joyfully as well as glorify God. And may the Lord continue to refresh you by His presence and reach you by His word.
Christians are called out of the world in order to be sent into the world. But one cannot be sent unless he is first called, because that calling brings us to God and makes us His possession. Thank you, Kenneth. This is Times of Refreshing, a ministry of Bethesda Hall in partnership with TWR Asia. And join us again tomorrow when Kenneth presents part 2 of Worldly Saints. Right now, though, we would love to hear from you, and I have several ways through which you can be in contact. You can send us a text message at 9431-3813, or you can write to us at Post Office Box 392, Thompson Road, Post Office, Singapore 915-714. You can go to our Facebook page and leave your comments there or share some views with some of the other folks you see. Also, I invite you to visit our website, www.timesofrefreshing.asia, where you can listen to the program right online. And Times of Refreshing has launched an iPhone app that allows users to directly access the broadcast messages and the podcasts right from their iPhones. I'm McDaniel Phillips, inviting you to join us again for Times of Refreshing.